We are coming to you live from around the world. I'm here at the global headquarters of one of the world's best capitalized banks and one of the world's best capitalized countries. And we want to talk to you today a little bit more about the roadmap for recovery, how we see things playing out with the election and COVID into next year. Now, as you know, we try to get as detailed as possible in these discussions, but of course, being a global call, it's probably going to be something where you might want to follow up with your advisor or the e-banking platform to get specific investment recommendations, how you can implement some of the ideas that we're going to be talking about. Now, I know that in many conversations around the firm and in many homes around the world, the topic is the U.S. election. And so we're going to talk about that first. And we've got Tom joining us on the phone live from the United States. You know, part of this roadmap for recovery should be something around ultimately getting some kind of stimulus in the United States, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be the first stop on our roadmap for recovery. So, Tom, maybe you can talk a little bit about that and what the U.S. outlook is, you know, this week and then through the election.
I'd be happy to, Mark, and good day, everyone. The dynamics of the U.S. presidential election have evolved a lot over the course of the past decade, and particularly in the context of COVID-19. Many state governments, and it's important to remember that the state governments in the United States run the elections, not the federal government, have eased a lot of the rules governing how people vote. First and foremost, we're voting a lot earlier here in the United States than we ever have before, either by mail or in person. And on the first slide, which we prepared just before the weekend, we had shown that there were 44 million people already voting in the various states. I checked this morning, and that number, based on data that was coming in late on Friday and over the weekend, indicates that we have almost 60 million people that have voted. At this rate, turnout among eligible voters will be the highest in more than 100 years. So there's clearly a lot of enthusiasm among the voters for the election. On page two, on slide two, you can take a look and see that the president is facing an uphill battle for re-election. His approval rating has remained in the 40 to 45% range, which is where it's been for most of his presidency. And when you go back for 75 years, U.S. presidents have periodically enjoyed higher popularity at some points during their tenure, even if those periods were relatively brief. Trump has never exceeded 50% in the 4 years that he's been in office. He's also up against history. The United States has never had four consecutive presidents elected to a second term in office. So he's trying to basically buck 240 years of history. It will come as not a whole lot of surprise to everyone on the call today that President Trump, in all probability, will lose the popular vote again. But of course, the Electoral College in the United States determines who wins the presidency. And that vote is determined on capturing enough states with enough electoral votes from those states to reach a majority. So if we look at slide three, we show the states where we think the presidential election will be either won or lost. Trump is trailing former Vice President Biden in 10 states that he won, albeit in some cases quite narrowly 4 years ago. Florida, as always, assumes outsized importance. If Trump loses Florida, it would suggest that his support among older voters and Latino voters has weakened, and his chances of winning through an Electoral College vote is negligible. So as we tune into the election results, as they're reported on Election Day, obviously focusing on Florida would be very important. The other state to watch is Pennsylvania. If Trump wins Florida but loses Pennsylvania, where the race has tightened a little bit up in the last couple of weeks, he then has to win Arizona, North Carolina, and Iowa, or again, he loses the election. So you can kind of see that the odds right now in terms of his performance in individual states is facing long odds. On slide four, we can see that the prediction markets are placing a high probability of a unified Congress under Democratic control. The odds of this happening are pretty high, but we expect that any Democratic majority will be narrow. In other words, if the Democrats take control of the Senate, we would expect that to happen with 51 or 52 seats. They need to pick up a net gain of 3 seats if former Vice President Biden wins, and 4 seats if he loses, based on the vote of the Vice President in the Senate. So in that case, even if the Democrats have a majority, you'd expect that the 7 or 8 centrist Democrats will wield a disproportionate amount of influence, as virtually all of their votes are going to be necessary to pass any major legislation. We might also be spending a good part of time in December and early January talking about parliamentary rules governing the passage of legislation, because some Republican votes will be needed unless certain rules regarding the filibuster, which if there are any questions we can follow up, are changed. I would suggest that we've got 2 opportunities next year to pass major legislation, either for fiscal stimulus, which appears to be first on Biden's agenda, and then later in the year, a tax increase. These can be done through budget reconciliation, and the Democrats will have 2 shots to do so. So you'll probably get a major fiscal package in the first quarter of 2021, and then a tax package probably in the third or probably the fourth quarter of 2021. And those will be the principal focuses next year. And with that, I'll kick it back to you, Mark.
All right, thank you. And there was a lot in what you said there, but I think one of the things to highlight, particularly to the international audience, is that, you know, we hear a lot about, oh, will we even know who was elected? But I think that that point on particularly Florida is very important, because the path for President Trump, if he loses Florida, which has a pretty robust process, is very narrow, and therefore it could be the election is called. As many recall, with Bush Gore, that was the state that caused a lot of the issues that dragged out the election. Okay, so the other hot topic, of course, is what is going on with COVID. And I am very pleased that Lachlan is joining us to give us a little perspective on that.
Well, thanks, Mark. So, as you say, it's a very hot topic at the moment, because we've seen an uptick in the cases in Europe and, of course, the reintroduction of targeted mobility restrictions as a result. And that's causing a lot of uncertainty in the populations about what we can do, what's safe to do. And the concern, of course, from an economic perspective, is that this leads to lower levels of economic activity. So development of vaccines and development of treatments remains a very important part of normalizing both government policy and also the population's fear of the virus as we move into 21. Now, on both sides, treatments and vaccines, we still think that developments are in line with our central scenario. And if we look at the first slide, we've laid out where things currently stand. Let me start with vaccines then, because it's most timely. And we continue to expect that there will be one or more vaccines widely available in major markets around the second quarter of next year. So very importantly, we're approaching the critical data from the first of the US phase 3 trials that could actually show us whether these leading vaccines are effective. The 2 leading vaccines in the US being developed by Pfizer and Moderna, and Pfizer has said it anticipates there to be interim data as soon as this month. Moderna anticipates that data coming in November. So let's be very clear about what this means. The timing, as well as obviously the outcomes of these studies, is uncertain. It's event-driven. We don't know precisely when we're going to see this data, but we do think it's more likely than not that we'll see the first efficacy data by the end of November. And what are those data going to show? There's a number of outcomes. One potential is that the trials are successful, and that would mean that they show the vaccines reduce the number of patients who have symptomatic COVID disease. It's also possible that the first results are inconclusive. That wouldn't mean that the vaccines don't work, just that we have to wait a little bit longer in order to find out. And of course, we can't rule out the risk that one or both of these trials actually comes back with a negative result, suggesting that that vaccine has no effect. But as I noted, our assessment, based on the data we've seen so far, as well as our analysis of the trial design, suggests that one or both of these leading vaccines will demonstrate it can reduce disease incidence, and we'll see that data by the end of next month. So it's very important that these vaccines are unlikely to be 100% effective, but if we see a reduction in the risk of developing COVID disease, that's going to contribute to a reduction of fear of the disease. Now, the efficacy data, therefore, are very important to get comfort that vaccines are coming. But if we think about the timelines, it'll take a few weeks to process the data and lead to regulatory review. And that would put first approvals maybe late this year in the US and then translate into wider approval around second quarter of 21, with Europe probably on a similar timeframe or a little bit behind. The question we get quite a lot is capacity. How many doses are going to be available? So on the right-hand side of this chart here, we put a graph that shows the number of doses per capita that could be available over the course of 2021 in these major economies. And we've broken it down by supplier to try to show how the governments have hedged their bets. Note that a lot of these vaccines are going to require two doses. The precise timing when they'll be available is going to be a function of which vaccines are successful and, of course, how quickly the companies can scale up manufacturing. But if we take the US as an example, our best estimate currently is that enough doses should be available by the second quarter to start vaccinating around half of the population, just based on those two leading vaccines. Now, if we move on to the second slide and turn to treatments, we can see here that the mortality rate, the light brown line, has been considerably lower in the current wave than in the early part of the year. And we think that a part of the reason for that is improvements in medical management and also the development with drug treatments. Here we think there's going to be more progress. One thing to look out for in the coming weeks is initial availability and more clinical data on the so-called therapeutic antibodies. These drugs have already shown they can reduce viral loads. They've shown they can speed up recovery of patients who are not in hospital. So even though there'll be a limited supply initially, if these drugs are approved, they should have a role to play keeping selected patients out of the hospital. So Mark, to sum up on that, vaccine data could come at any time. And based on our current timeframes, our central scenario still calls for widespread availability of vaccines in the second quarter of next year. To see a downside scenario, we'd have to have a material delay to those efficacy results or a safety setback that would push wider availability out into late 21. And on the other hand, if we see a vaccine that's more effective than current estimates or comes earlier, that would be consistent with our upside scenario. So back to you, Mark.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I think... I'm glad you touched on this efficacy, because a lot of people just look at doses available. But of course, if a vaccine is very efficacious, then fewer people, you know, fewer doses need to be made available, fewer people need to be inoculated before you start to show the herd immunity. So you kind of have to look at both stats. It's like that, you know, you start exercising and they say, throw out the scales. It's not how much you weigh. It's how much muscle you have. And so everything's more complex. And then the other point, I think, you know, as we start talking about renewed restrictions and things, I think you have to place that, you know, does that mean that the recovery is about to fall off a cliff? And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm very grateful for that we did this year was we had a view that the recovery would be stronger than many economists outside of our team were predicting. And therefore, as you know, we bet on the upside risk with risky assets to a degree. So the reason I say it like that is because the recovery has been stronger than many thought it would be. And therefore, there's a little room for some give back here without such a significant slowdown. Now, of course, if we get to the end of the year and the continued mobility restrictions are in place and we have no stimulus, that's a different story. But, you know, this is something we're watching closely, and it's not something we're panicking about right now. But with that, I think not to steal Mark Anderson's thunder. Mark, why don't we hand it over to you and how we see risk assets from here and what people should be investing in right now?
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Mark. And I think with the background of what we heard both from Lackland and from Tom, it's exciting both to see how the economy developed. Obviously, risk asset has done very well over the last 6 months as the global economy has recovered. But now that we're into the third quarter earnings season, I also wanted to pause quickly to see what does that mean in terms of how companies are doing and obviously where we want to be invested in this kind of environment. Lachlan already noted that in Europe, we're obviously seeing that some of the COVID cases are coming back at full form. We've seen that from Google Mobility reports that overall we are moving a bit less around on the European continent. And it also means that some of the latest business confidence indicators have slowed a little bit. So we're seeing a bit of a stall in the European economy, which is on the other hand side balanced by a US economy, which remains relatively strong. So no really impact in terms of mobility reports in the US. If anything, we see that some of this pent-up demand has led to very, very strong pickup in retail sales recently. And maybe to round it off with China, again, very strong data, both when it comes to lending as well as retail sales as well. So for the first slide I wanted to show is really these purchase manager indices, so the business confidence on a global basis. And while we've certainly seen a bit of a stall in the recovery from the third quarter, we're still seeing into the fourth quarter that we have an overall broad-based still recovery, even if somewhat slower in Europe. I would also note that in Europe, that while we might be seeing Google mobility reports becoming somewhat down, we also note that fiscal stimulus into 2021 has really been announced to be very strong and lends itself into a continued recovery as these vaccines become available that Lachlan talked about before. What does this mean for companies and their earnings? Well, if we go to the US, where we have the third quarter earnings seasons in full swing, and with a nice slide number two highlighting how those reports have been coming in, we really note that what is the traditional patterns of companies guiding lower into the quarter earnings seasons really starting only to surprise somewhat on the positive side has been really quite different in this third quarter, where first of all we've seen that earnings on a broad basis really starting to surprise on the upside. And very importantly as well is that what was really taking equities back in the earlier part of the year was to a large degree also this visibility we simply didn't have in terms of what was the earnings companies were expected to be making in this very, very uncertain COVID-19 environment. And here the answer is certainly that many companies and particularly sectors around technology, consumer sales, etc., is faring well, and the rest of us is starting a pickup also. That has reflected itself, of course, in share prices as well. So we note that, of course, the large US tech companies have done extremely well in terms of share price developments, consumer staples, etc. And we think as this recovery gets going into the 2021 period where vaccines will be available, fiscal stimulus is likely still there on a global basis, we're likely to see that it's more the cyclical, both sectors and areas, that will see a stronger performance on the share prices. So we note cyclical sectors like industrials, materials, we like small and mid-cap companies, countries where we are exposed to those things, such as the UK. If we look at technology, we obviously are excited about a lot of the trends that are being accelerated by COVID-19, but really find the best upside in areas that might not be the most visible when we look at really the largest companies, in particular in the US. And here are four investment themes on the final slide that I would like to highlight that our broad team of analysts think is particularly exciting at this point in time. So the first thing I want to highlight is 5G. So for many of us, we of course question, well, is my life really going to change if my internet speed on my phone is going to be 20 times quicker? And maybe not, but in other areas such as autonomous driving, virtual reality, AI, etc., this is going to be a real game changer, and there's going to be a lot of application coming on the back of this. And we're likely to see 5G CapEx spending in the area of $150 billion per annum when we reach 2025. So 5G is accelerating a lot of opportunities in the digital space. Europe's green tech leaders is another one, which is very exciting, which is coming out of the fiscal stimulus that has been announced in Europe following COVID, where it's accelerated the agenda of trying to reach carbon neutrality in Europe by 2050. And it basically lends a lot of opportunity to energy companies, building companies, and in many other sectors that are progressing this agenda. China's digital economy, again, here's a number of companies that are not expensively priced compared to some of the large US tech names. And this is in particular in areas like e-commerce, online platforms, it is areas like online holiday planning, etc. So here we see great opportunities for some of the names in China that are a little bit below kind of the very familiar names. And finally, I would highlight fintech, where obviously we've seen payment services take off, and in general, a broader emerging landscape of consumers that maybe have not banked before that has this accessibility via fintech. So to sum up, Mark, we still have a global economy which remains on its recovery track despite some pickup in COVID cases, and there's still great opportunities for investors to pick up names outside of those that have done already very well. Back to you, Mark.
All right, thanks, Mark. Now on to Tim to talk about where yield-seeking investors are or will be, given this talk of fiscal stimulus and the ongoing monetary stimulus. So Tim, take it away.
Thank you, Mark. So fixed income markets have rallied quite a fair bit since March on the back of the Fed's move to cut interest rates to zero. So with the exception of a few subcategories, the majority of fixed income indexes are now in positive territories. So with the strong performance, yield for US dollar bonds have also compressed subsequently. IG bond yields are now about 2.5% after compressing about 1%, and global high yield bonds are now between 6 to 8% after compressing about 2%. So despite lower yields in general, we still think it makes sense for investors to own bonds, as interest rates are expected to stay low for the foreseeable future. And the US Federal Reserve has even indicated to the markets that they will not raise interest rates for the next 3 years. So for investors looking for yield, we think that there are three areas in the bond market which are still interesting, where yields are high, valuations are still attractive, and in which there are potential for spread compression as well. So first of all, on Asia high yield bonds. For Asia high yield bonds, I want to highlight that the key sector to monitor from a fundamental perspective is the China property sector. So for investors who are unfamiliar with the China property sector, developers are essentially home builders who acquire land and develop them into multi-family homes and sell them for a profit. Can I have the next slide, please? So this sector is a key component of the Asia High Yield Index and accounts for about one third of the index weight. So we are constructive for two reasons. So I think, first of all, we expect credit metrics to remain relatively stable despite the pandemic. So despite the very slow sales of homes in the first quarter, we saw very strong pent-up demand coming back in the second quarter. First half EBITDA for companies in under our coverage was actually up about 2% on a year-on-year basis. And this compares with about EBITDA, which is down about 30 to 50% for the rest of the high yield space. So second half numbers for the sector is expected to be even stronger due to seasonal effects, as sales are usually back-end loaded during the third and the fourth quarter. Second, we expect the Chinese government's policy for the property sector to be very supportive. In today's context, it will neither be too restrictive nor will it be too loose. The key is to allow a gradual increase in property prices on a year-on-year basis, rather than to let it run away or collapse. So far, prices this year on a national aggregate level are up about 5%, which we think are still acceptable to the government. A supportive policy generally translates into a funding environment that is positive for developers. So the key for Asia, the key risk for Asia high yield at this point, right, is that there's still a portion of the index that is under pressure for refinancing in 2021. So we will continue to keep a very close eye on that. So next slide, please. The next segment of the market which we find really interesting is the emerging market sovereign bonds. So EM sovereign bonds is one of our most preferred bond sub-asset classes. Yields are currently about 5.1% and spreads are about 410 basis points. So we expect credit spreads to tighten, driven mainly by the laggards in the EM sovereign bond space, which are the high yield portion of the index. Valuation for EM sovereign high yield is currently in the top quartile range when compared to the historical 10-year average. So that means they are attractive on a historical basis. Technicals for EM sovereign bonds have also been improving, particularly in the primary market, where we have seen record volumes of bond issuance. So what does that mean? So that means that EM countries are able to access the capital markets with ease. With anticipated recovery in the global economy in the next year, we still expect credit spreads to tighten gradually over the next 12 months. Lastly, I want to talk about green bonds. Can I have the next slide as well? So interestingly, the question that I get the most from investors nowadays is, what are green bonds? And for those who are not familiar with green bonds, these are bonds that are issued by companies to fund projects with environmental or climate-related benefits. Projects include renewable energy, water and waste treatment, and clean transportation. So issuance has picked up over the last 5 years. The total market cap globally is now slightly under $1 trillion, at about $900 billion. Issuer profile for green bonds tend to be solid investment-grade companies. The biggest sectors that issue green bonds are banks, utilities, and public sector agencies. So demand for green bonds has been very strong over the last couple of years due to the rise of sustainable investing globally. Because of the scarcity value of these bonds, they also tend to be very resilient during times of volatility, so where they sell off a lot less. So we saw green bonds outperform substantially versus global bonds in March and April during the depth of the global sell-off. We actually think that the addition of green bonds to a global fixed income portfolio really helps to diversify and reduce risk further. So in summary, I think investors looking for yield can look at Asia US dollar high yield bonds, as well as emerging market sovereign bonds, and to diversify risk further, could consider green bonds as well. Back over to you, Mark.
All right, thanks a lot, Tim. Now we just have a couple of minutes to delve deeper into a few of these topics. I want to go back to Tom and the election. And, you know, one of the things I think it's important to say, both about the election or COVID and other topics, is that we in the CIO office are not here to tell everyone how we think the world should work. Our job is to describe how we think it does work. That said, you know, there are many clients and advisors who, let's be honest, if we've surveyed business owners, and the majority of them have expressed a preference for President Trump. So we get a lot of emails, people asking, yeah, I know the polls, but, you know, the polls were wrong last time. Are they wrong this time? And this is something, Tom, you've looked into. So can you say a few words about that?
Yeah, of course, Mark. Interestingly enough, the polls were wrong in a few selected states that proved to be very important for the outcome of the 2016 election. As we approach the last 2 days of that 2016 election, Secretary Clinton was forecasted to win by 3 points. She actually won by 2.1 in the popular vote. So the national polls were actually within the margin of error. Where the polls went wrong in 2016 was in some critical Midwestern states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, also Minnesota, although Secretary Clinton did win that state narrowly. So what happened was that most of the pollsters had insufficiently weighted education, the level of education attainment among prospective voters. And in doing so, they undercounted rural voters in those four states. And of course, President Trump had taken a lot of the undecided rural voters without a college education, and they broke very heavily towards him in the last week of the election. And of course, he won three of those four states by very narrow margins. Each of the reputable polling companies have basically corrected for that, which is not to suggest that we might not have another error that could occur. It certainly could. But the weighting that each of the polls have placed on not only education, but on a diversity of respondents is much improved over what it was in 2016. So we do believe the polls are more accurate than they were. Another important consideration is that the former vice president is ahead of where Secretary Clinton was as we get closer to the election. So with 9 days left in the election, Biden has a bigger lead on Trump. And the final consideration is that Trump is now an incumbent. We had no incumbent running. And so therefore, the president is on the defensive, particularly as it relates to COVID-19. You know, and the final, I guess, observation is that we don't know for sure, of course. I mean, this election could get tighter. In fact, it probably will get a little bit tighter over the course of this final week. But we have more people voting well in advance. We have many more people voting early. So to some degree, the die has already been cast for a significant part of the voting population. We'll see what happens, but I suspect Biden is in a better position than Secretary Clinton was 4 years ago.
All right, thank you. Well, it looks like that is about all we have time for today. So just to summarize, yes, there is near-term volatility, which we're hoping that many of you use to your advantage, because when you look out into next year and you think about the election being resolved, likely resolved with some form of further stimulus, China continuing to power ahead, and generally speaking, a better handle on COVID through drugs and vaccines, this recovery can still continue. And that makes us believe in our base case that major indices can move higher from here, and that certain sectors and themes are going to do very well indeed. So with that, I wish you all well, make it a great day, and talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.